So our next item is going to be a report from our state water board liaison, Ms. Statterlo, and we appreciate you coming for today's meeting.
Good morning. Good to see you all. First of all, thank you, Ms. Hunter, for that report. That was really interesting information, and seeing how efforts that are underway through the state board and the administration fit in with much of the work that you all are doing here on the ground at Region 3. So thank you for that. Along those lines, I wanted to start off by updating you on the safe drinking water proposal. I believe I've spoken about it in the past. And just as an update, the language was proposed to be part of the trailer bill to be adopted by the budget. That was a proposal by the administration, and very close, but it didn't make it in the budget. But the legislature did indicate, as part of moving forward on this, that this is an area that perhaps the specific type of solution, there just wasn't consensus on the issue in particular regarding the fee on water systems throughout the state, but that the legislature is definitely interested in continuing to work with the administration, the balance of the legislative session, to see if there's another approach that we could find agreement on. This is a two-thirds, as structured, it was a two-thirds requirement, and they did not have the votes. But in indicating the interest that the legislature does have on this issue, they did include a one-time set-aside of $24 million for the program to be determined as far as distribution at a later point. So it's sort of more along the lines of what I would call a placeholder. And then our staff is doing another round of discussions on information that they need to put together a report that's required under AB 401, the affordability piece of the safe and affordable drinking water under the human right to water. And so that report is under development, and I expect that it will be released to the legislature later this year, by the end of the year. Along the lines of legislative activity, there was a significant package of bills that the legislature approved and the governor signed regarding conservation. And so, as you recall, I believe I've reported several times during the drought regarding our emergency authorities on water conservation and the percent reduction that we were, as a state, expecting all communities to obtain during the drought. What we could see through that process was it was a successful program. Communities really stepped up. Everyone in the state stepped up, and we saw a reduction, cumulative reduction, of over 4 million acre feet. So significant progress was made, but we're really at a place where we need to transition about, moving more toward a permanent program and not a program that just focuses on a crisis period where we're expecting everyone during that crisis period to conserve. Really what we need to be looking at is implementation on a permanent basis of conservation as a way of life, just a different way of thinking in California, which meets the goals that we have under the Water Action Plan and also other goals that we have, for example, climate change and what we can do to address climate change in California. And so the legislature really in negotiation with the administration put together a package of bills, SB 606, Skinner and Hertzberg, and then AB 1668 by Friedman. And between these two bills, what we have now is the development and direction to our board and the Department of Water Resources for the long-term water efficiency program. So we're really transitioning more to looking at efficiency as opposed to conservation. reduction in use across the board, urban use, agricultural use, commercial, industrial use. And so what this package does is require water agencies to develop a budget. And that budget would be comprised of a water budget comprised of three components. First of all, the indoor water use, which the legislature has already told us that we are looking at a indoor water use of 55 gallons per capita per day. And there's been a lot of confusion in the press about this. This does not require each of us individually to reduce by 55 gallons per capita per day, and with the State Water Board ready to come in and enforce against each individual household. It is the component that would go into the calculation of the budget for the indoor water use. So the way that would work is if you have 20,000 residents that are served by a water agency, 20,000 by 55 gallons per capita per day, and that becomes the indoor water use budget for the water agency. So that's component number one. Component number two is the aggregate outdoor water use, and that would be determined as a result of guidelines that we, the State Water Board, would be developing in conjunction with the Department of Water Resources. And that time frame is, I'm looking here for the date, 2023. We'd be adopting this in 2022, effective 2023. And so we have, over the next several years, we're going to be very busy working with the Department of Water Resources on the development of this outdoor water component that would include residential, commercial, industrial. And then the last component is a place to account for reduction in leaks. So we have been required under previous legislation to establish guidelines for leak detection and minimization of leaks. And that'll be the first action that our board will be taking on this new efficiency standard. We will be adopting those guidelines in 2020. And then once we have those guidelines, then of course the water agencies would be using them for that third component of the budget. Let's see here, looking for additional information that would be useful. The legislature in the indoor water use component also has directed that the initial indoor water use would be 55 gallons per capita per day, and it will be ratcheting down through time, getting to 50 gallons per capita per day by 2030. So in some areas, 55 gallons per capita per day is going to be easy to achieve. In fact, they're already achieving this. But again, we're looking at a statewide program and then going further through time. Okay, the next thing I wanted to update you on is climate change. As you may recall, this was an issue that was before the WQCC, looking at the various activities that are going on throughout the regions on climate change. And this all started with the resolution that our board adopted in 2017, really an effort to recognize some of the things that we're already doing, for example, in the area of conservation, and then looking at what we can do across all programs to be addressing, mitigating climate change, taking actions, focusing on adaptation to climate change, really a comprehensive program. And since that time, the regions have been busy at work. I know from conversations that I've had with your chair and executive officer this is an issue that your executive officer will be bringing up soon and providing various options as to how Region 3 might want to approach its role on climate change. But just as an update as to what other regions are doing, Regions 4, 6, and 9 have all adopted resolutions. Region 5 has taken a bit of a different approach. They've adopted a work plan. And then regions one and two have also taken a different approach. Again, this is not a one-size-fits-all coming down from the top. Our resolution really directs and encourages the regions to develop their own program. And region one and two have focused more on regulatory actions and things that they can do through the evaluations of their permits. In particular, a readiness study plan in region one as their focus, again, through regulatory actions and permits. So look forward to, hopefully, I'll be able to attend the meeting when you bring this up, and looking forward to a good, robust discussion over here at Region 3. All right, your executive officer was interested in getting an update on the budget. So aside from the safe drinking water piece, the budget that was adopted across the water boards, it's a $1.2 billion budget and 2,000 positions. This is less than the previous year, but that's really because the previous years had been, we had seen a lot of activity on distribution for Prop 1. And so those funds, we still are distributing those dollars, but not as much as in years past. And then with respect to Region 3, 76.2 authorized positions and approximately $15 million in funding for this next fiscal year. And then speaking of bonds, Prop 68 was approved by the voters, authorizing $4 billion in parks and water projects. And so as Prop 1 sort of, is those funds are completed, we're going to see an infusion of additional dollars, really focusing on continuation of a lot of the work that we were already doing under Prop 1. So the State Water Board, we expect it will be administering $460 million, $250 million for drinking water and wastewater with a priority for disadvantaged communities. So many of those projects that Ms. Hunter was talking about, hopefully we'll be able to see some additional funding. $80 million for groundwater treatment and remediation, $50 million for groundwater regional sustainability, $80 million for water recycling. And then as we are in the process of developing the distribution and guidelines for Prop 68, there's another bond that has qualified for the November ballot, another water bond, and that's an $8.8 billion water bond. And if we look at the language in that bond and what it sets aside for programs under our reach, we would be seeing an additional $2 billion. So it's really exciting that as a state, this is a priority and seems to continue to be a priority for the voters as well. So I'm sure many of you will be either closely following this or maybe even advocating on behalf of the passage of the water bond in the November ballot. Okay, and then lastly, I wanted to give you an update on the wine reorder, knowing that this is something that you all are very much interested in, and our staff continues to be developing the wine reorder. And I'm actually looking here to see if I got an email. I had asked our staff to give me an additional update. So what I've been told is that there is a work group that's been formed with the regions that have a particular focus on the wine reorder. So that would be Region 3, Regions 1 and 2, Region 5, and then also Region 9. So it's quite a large work group in conjunction with the stakeholders. And the language is, currently being developed, and the regional boards have an access to, at this point, an administrative draft that the staff has put together. But we're a long ways from a final document. And so what we need to do and what we have committed to do is hold workshops, and we have a commitment to have a workshop here in Region 3. I had hoped to have a date for you, but I don't have a date yet, and I know from talking with Chair Wolf, that there is, a concern that we get a workshop here, but that it be at the right time, because you have harvest coming up. And so people, many of the folks that this would impact are going to be busy doing other activities very soon. So we'll continue to work with you on that and hopefully find a date and time that works best for you all and the stakeholders. And so the plan at this point is still to have a document to be released in this summer. I have to say, I think that's going to be, it seems to be difficult to be achieved, because we haven't even yet received our briefings as board members. So stay tuned on that. I suspect that there might be some slippage, but the goal is to have this ready for adoption in January of 2019. So that's all I have for you, and would welcome any questions.
I'll start with Mayor Delgado.
Thanks, Doreen, for being here. On the planned water conservation bills, or I should say plans, you mentioned three areas: indoor water use, aggregate outdoor water use, and reduction in leaks. On the aggregate outdoor water use, at the end of your comment, you said that would include residential, industrial, and commercial. So my question is, do any of those three address agricultural?
No, they don't. The water, the efficiency legislation also contains requirements for agricultural water use plans. And so water districts have requirements to put together their plans, their drought resiliency plans, and submit them to the Department of Water Resources. And so there's a separate piece on agriculture, and they wouldn't be included in, because these agencies are urban agencies that are the focus of the three points that I had mentioned for the budget.
Is it anticipated that the agricultural plans would include numeric targets or numeric requirements like the urban requirements?
No, not that I know of. No, they would be, they are, they require the agricultural agencies of certain sizes, and I hadn't planned on talking about that today, so I'm not in a position to, I just don't recall the exact provisions, but they do not include targets. What they do is they require that the agricultural districts prepare information about their access, their water portfolio, and how they would sustain themselves through a drought period.
Well, earlier you mentioned that we're not just looking at crisis drought related. So will the agricultural piece address long-term conservation?
I think the focus right now on agriculture is to make sure, first of all, that they take reporting seriously. I think there's been, some agencies take it very seriously, and others have not provided those reports. And so, first of all, to make sure that the reports get submitted. Secondly, I believe that the Department of Water Resources is going to be changing how the reporting occurs. Instead of paper filing, getting the reports submitted electronically, so that there's improved transparency of those reports. And then thirdly, the focus includes a drought resiliency piece. And so as we saw from the last drought, the challenge that many agricultural water districts had was that it was a very the water rights system impacted some districts in a very significant way, in that because of their junior status, they may have ended up with just a zero water supply. And so the focus really is make sure they understand what their water sources are, and if they don't have enough, they should be looking at other more resilient supplies. There is not a one-size-fits-all approach, and that's not that wasn't even part of the discussion, as far as I know. I wasn't involved in the deliberations on the legislation, but the focus really was to just make sure that they turn in the reports and that there's a good understanding of the portfolio of water supply that the various districts have, really pushing them toward their own deliberations and discussions about how to better use what they do have and how to prepare for drought so that we don't have this situation of, you know, many districts, particularly in the San Joaquin Valley, were reliant, overly reliant on groundwater. And so we saw, of course, subsidence in some areas. So many of these pieces are going to be fitting in at about the same time that will drive ag efficiency, but there's not a specific target for ag efficiency because there just isn't a one-size-fits-all.
So why do you think the mandatory beyond the push, you know, we've gone through urban recommendations, suggestions to crisis mandates, and now we're moving toward urban permanent mandates, which I support 100%. Why do you think those urban, why do you think that urban process is further along than the non-urban process?
I would not say that it's further along. I would actually say that there are many areas of the state where agriculture has been, has pushed technology and efficiency to amazing limits because of the very issue, because of water supply challenges, whether it be saltwater intrusion issues that many of you see here, or whether it be the challenges with limited supplies, limited surface supplies, or groundwater management. And so what we've seen, and again, I don't have the numbers before me, but inefficiency in producing more crop per drop. And we have seen tremendous change. I know in my family's own farm, I mean, what they were doing on 3 acre feet years ago and bringing it down to, you know, just slightly above 2 acre feet, producing the same crop but with higher yield and less water. And so I think that, you know, again, one size does not fit all. There might be some areas where flood irrigation makes sense as a conjunctive use system. And so for us in Sacramento to dictate the amount of acre feet that would be used, you know, per acre in California, it would be, I personally, I think it would be impossible to come up with a formula. And secondly, I think that it could impact other things that are being done in the way of water management, for example, groundwater recharge. And then in other areas, you know, you don't want to see that at all. You want to really limit the amount of water use, maybe because of soil types or other things. So I think, again, we really are moving in that direction, and tremendous efforts have been made. I think your chair could probably speak to this better than I could about, you know, some of the specific crops and what we've seen in the way of efficiency and reduced water use. Again, reduced water use, but the idea is to make sure that we're getting the most crop per drop with the water that's applied.
So just an update on Monterey County. We have serious seawater intrusion issues, and we rely almost entirely on groundwater. And where the seawater intrusion, it's 5 miles for the 400-foot well, 7 miles for that one, 5 miles for that one, and it's 7 miles for the 180-foot aquifer. Within those seawater intruded areas, there are more wells being installed to go into the deeper 900-foot aquifer. So I think we may be using more water than we have in the past from our deep aquifer, and it's because there's been overdraft of the upper aquifers.
Mm-hmm.
And so while we worry about toilets and sinks and landscaping in the urban, I'm told that in Monterey, by various reports, they're all around the 85% to 90% range of water use coming from agriculture. So while we have established mandates on the 10% to 15% urban use, and we have more wells going in for ag use, even within our seawater intruded zones, of course I'm concerned about our future water.
Sure, I understand that. And I think that's the beauty of SGMA. You know, SGMA, the legislature recognized this is not a program that can be dictated by Sacramento on what's the appropriate, what is sustainable for the basin. And so the locals have the tools that they need. They've got timelines. And so I really do expect that there are going to be some areas of the state where you're going to see significant fallowing programs, and that is overall in certain areas going to result in a reduction in ag water use. But again, the focus is in that context on sustainability and what actions can be taken to bring basins into sustainability, and that would be a piece of the portfolio that the Agricultural Water District would have to take account for. In some areas, such as the area you're talking about, we're talking about almost an exclusive reliance on groundwater, so the focus with the real driver is going to be SGMA. In other areas, not so much. You know, in some areas of the state, they're focusing almost exclusively on surface water, which is a problem of a different kind, because then when we don't have enough precipitation, enough water moving through the state and federal projects, then those districts can end up seeing, you know, a zero water supply allocation. And so it just really depends on the resources that the individual agricultural water districts have. Thanks.
Thank you for your questions, Bruce. I appreciated those. And thank you, Dee, for coming out. I appreciate your thorough summary of what's happening. There's quite a lot going on, so just a couple of things. Firstly, I wanted to touch base a little bit on what Dr. Hunter said. And, you know, there's obviously a tremendous amount of work going on in the EJ community, a lot of which sort of provides insights into really the more of the work that needs to be done. And a lot of the work through the Disadvantaged Community Involvement Grant has been funded by Prop 1 through the IWM program, so that's all IRWIT monies. And we in the Central Coast are doing a huge needs assessment that will hopefully dovetail with some of the work that's already underway and potentially going to be underway with community water. But as we dig deeper into the situation, I think, you know, we're leaving folks out, first and foremost, within that MHI, sort of, that's not necessarily something that you can cure. This is a legislative fix, but under, you know, Water Code, we deal with MHI, and MHI is not always the best indicator of disadvantage. For example, you have lots of different households living in one house oftentimes, and so, you know, that provides a really skewed approach to the way that funding comes through to the regions. And really doesn't allow us to dig in as deep as we possibly can. So maybe that's an area that the State Board can provide some leadership on in terms of the definition of disadvantaged, severely disadvantaged, and those types of MHI issues. And then secondly, again, this is not a State Board issue, and this is a huge societal issue, but we have a lot of underrepresented communities and vulnerable populations, unsheltered, people who have no permanent shelter, and that's a huge impact on our watersheds and our water resources. So folks that are living, you know, in creek beds, in riverbeds, and are providing, let's say, non-point source pollution opportunities, you know, definitely has a large statewide impact. And I don't know where State Board is on leadership on some of those issues and funding on those issues. And again, that's not, you know, exclusively a DWR Water Board issue. It's not necessarily a water issue exclusively, but it is something that we do need to get our hands around, and to the, you know, to the extent that we could have, you know, more dialogue. I know we had a WQCC and leadership with State Board, or in some sort of interagency communication at the state level on these issues. I think it would be really helpful, and then also target funding, because under IRWM, for example, Santa Barbara County is going to be putting in a section into our disadvantaged community section, which is a requirement of the plan, dialoguing around, you know, vulnerable communities, underrepresented communities, but there's no funding to deal with some of those watershed impacts. Even though we have funds, we're not really allowed to use them for those types of discussions or projects. So those are some comments. They're large and global, but I did want to bring them to your attention. And then finally, just wanted to say thanks for the leadership on the climate change and adaptation. That's obviously something we haven't been really good at doing, and so I look forward to digging in a little bit further this year on that issue. So thanks.
Thank you. So with respect to the MHI and other issues, I think the appropriate time would be to, as we develop guidelines for the distribution of dollars under Prop 68, that would be a great opportunity to dialogue. Maybe Mr. Robertson and others can be coming up with some suggestions or at least flagging issues for us where the old guidelines didn't quite work, you know, as far as pigeonholing things. So that would be a good opportunity. And then I couldn't agree with you more on your concerns raised about the homeless issue and the impact on our waterways. And of course, that's a challenge because of the societal challenges that we have. It's not so easy to just say, you know, as a water board, get out of that area. But nonetheless, we are seeing impacts. And the focus, the tool that can be used is a stormwater permits and enforcement. And so what we are seeing, some of the other regions that are doing, in particular, I think it's region one or two, that has an education and outreach program. And I just received a video on that. And they are seeing collaboration with Coast Keepers, and they are seeing some improvements in some of the targeted water bodies that they were concerned about. So I will see if I can get a hold of that and send it your way.
I can supplement a little bit the question from Ms. Gray first to help me with the big alphabet soup within the world of water. Can you tell me what HMI stands for? Is that a...
Median household income.
Sorry.
One more time.
Median household income.
Okay.
Sorry.
All right. Thanks. so I'm not ashamed sometimes.
Yes.
When I
sorry.
Don't know the acronym to say, what does it mean? To further answer the question from Ms. Gray, you know, I'm one of the three chair part of a subcommittee for WQCC 2018, and what we have all agreed on as of Monday at our last conference call with our liaison, Mr. Steve Moore, is that on the Tuesday, October 23rd, which is the first day of WQCC, we will have from 1:30 to 3 p.m. Homeless and water quality session. This session includes a panel of experts on the issue of homelessness, impact on water quality. We'll have potential panelists from the Santa Ana River, San Jose, Oakland, San Diego, to discuss in great detail that issue. So the idea is to share what's happening with other regions and allow then other regions who are just, you know, in the development stage of these issues to address it. And I know you mentioned that to me last meeting, so that was my follow-up, is that it will happen. So another reflection that I have, and this one relates to Mayor Delgado, you know, justified concerns over water conservation associated with agriculture. I think when we look at agriculture, water use, and the long-term solution, we need to look at it as a three-legged stool. One of them is water conservation, but the second one is water augmentation, and the third one is water innovation. So conservation alone, I think, is not going to address the issues of climate change. But augmentation, and when I refer to augmentation, it includes, for example, stormwater capturing, you know, groundwater recharge, recycling, in some parts of a state, possibly modification of, you know, reservoir capacity. So all of those need to be part of a portfolio of water augmentation. And then the last one is innovation. And, you know, you did touch base on that a little bit, is that there's been quite a bit of efforts and improvements made in technology. For example, increased amount of SIMS stations, which are very precision-based weather stations, to provide real-time access to evapotranspiration, so you maximize the efficiency of your crop, to the use of soil moisture sensors, the use of apps, which connect directly these smart stations and soil sensors to your cell phone. So there's a lot of work being done, and specifically in the Salinas Valley, for example, there's there are miles. I can't quote you exactly how many miles, but there's a lot of miles of drip line conversion that has been taking place recently. You know, that information certainly would be available by, you know, from some of the suppliers. So those are, you know, some of the example. Other examples, you know, we talk about technology is, for example, very recently, the Almond Commission, they have put quite a bit of research money in developing sap monitoring systems, which are little sensors embedded in the trunk of the almond tree to use as a real-time base the calculation of the amount of water that the tree needs. That is actually more of an in-situ approach, even better than having nearby water sensors, soil moisture sensors. So that's an example. That's taking place right now as we speak as a bit of a research. And I use the example of almond because it's an important one because, you know, trees do use a fair amount of water. So this technology will be transferable to, say, the citrus, you know, and other areas. So all I want to mention is that I totally agree with you. And, you know, if you're a single family dwelling, say, hey, how come I have to cut back? And yet I see fields being irrigated. But I think in the totality, there's quite a bit of work, you know, being done in that area. And I think you see it yourself probably with some of the reports that you get at the state board level. So then very quickly, one little question, you know, when back to the per capita use, I know that there were challenges in being able to harmonize some standard associated with gray water use. And is it related, for example, to the Uniform Building Code? Where I'm getting at is that, you know, we use drinking water for flushing in toilets. That's not best use of water. And in some other advanced countries, they do have a separate system with gray water system where you take, say, the shower water or the laundry water, and that water is being recaptured and used for, you know, gray water application. And where a lot of problems were taking place is in the Uniform Building Code and then local codes, plumbing codes saying, no, you know, we don't want to go there. So I'm just bringing that up, that this is another example where I think sometimes there is a need to work with other agencies within the big family of the state of California, you know, regulatory arms.
Oh, definitely. And that'll be part of the process as the guidelines for outdoor are developed in conjunction with the Department of Water Resources, most definitely. And then I don't believe anything in particular was called out on gray water, but there is a, as part of that three-component water budget, there are credits allowed for the development of recycled water and desal projects. So the idea there is that communities ought not to be punished that are looking at investment in drought-resilient water supplies. So I'm oversimplifying the budget. There are other factors that can be considered in making adjustments to those water budgets. The devil will be in the details, you know, as things get further developed.
Thank you, Dee Dee.
Thank you for updating us on, especially on the safe drinking water proposal and that three-pronged approach. The one that kind of perked my ears up is the leak, looking at leak problems, leakage problems, and better management. And that gets right to the heart of aging water systems. And I'm just curious, and if you know, or if it's advanced to the point where some of these details are being fleshed out, but are there incentives as well as penalties, or Is this just guidance, or how do you envision this moving forward? Because I feel, in particular, some of the private water purveyors, it's a huge problem that stakeholders have been doing what they can to bring this to light, that management of these systems has, for decades, allowed for these systems to just decay, degrade, and now in, you know, doing catch-up, how do we incentivize where the cost factor is going to come up? Are ratepayers going to get stuck with complete overhauls of systems that are just beyond repair? Or do you have any little bit more detail for us on this?
Well, what I can tell you on that is I think the beauty of this conservation program evolving into an efficiency program, we really have come a long way in our stakeholder process. And we have, for example, a lot of the same players are involved in these various discussions. And on leak detection, what we're looking at, of course, we can't eliminate all leaks. And so it's an issue of matter of degree, efficiency, affordability. All of those will go into the determination of the development of these guidelines. And we have a very robust stakeholder process that is currently underway. I wish I could have attended some of those workshops. It's been in the middle of our water fix proceedings, but we've had a number of them throughout the state, and stakeholders are very much involved. I really don't know the outcome of those discussions, but it's something that we're committed to, a transparent process. And we really do want to get input, because we're not running these systems, but we want to hear from others that have engaged in successful leak detection. Again, it kind of gets back to the issue of technology. How can we detect those leaks, you know, in an affordable, efficient way, and then do something about them? And how do we prioritize the leaks? And so this will evolve into a set of guidelines that will be a component of that water budget. And the overall water budget, so really the water suppliers, they will announce to us, they will, once they get these components, they will let us know this is our objective, and this is something that will be enforceable, that has to be met. And so we're not looking at, it's a guideline to make a determination as to that number in the budget, but the budget itself will be enforceable.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
All right, so my colleagues, no more questions. So thank you so much for giving you this presentation and further enhance the topics with question and answers.
Thank you.
Thanks again.
Good to see you, and I plan on hanging out for most of the day. You've got some good agenda items I'm interested in hearing. Thanks.
All right, thanks again. Keep up the good work.